Hello and welcome to the UC Press Podcast, the podcast from the University of California Press. My name is Chris Gondek, and today I'm speaking with Scott Christensen, the author of The Last Gasp, The Rise and Fall of the American Gas Chamber. Scott Christensen is a writer, investigative reporter, and historian. He's the author of several acclaimed books, including With Liberty for Some, 500 Years of Imprisonment in America, winner of the Robert F. Kennedy Book Award Distinguished Honors, and a Choice Outstanding Book Award. His book, Condemned, Inside the Sing Sing Death House, was the subject of feature stories in The Village Voice, The New York Times, The Nation, and on the History Channel. Scott Christensen, thanks so much for taking time to talk to the University of California Press podcast today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You know, when people think about the gas chamber today, two images that come to my mind anyway are American prisons and German concentration camps. But I got from your book that the poison gas first entered the world awareness on the battlefields of the First World War. How was the decision made to use it in battle?
Well, it is true that, of course, we have this iconic image of the gas chamber that has come to us from the 20th century, this horrific image. But, in fact, it was the late part of the 19th century that the industrial age began to bring with it various kinds of poison gases that were being used in industry. And some of these were being put to use in Germany, in particular. It happened that in World War I, shortly after the beginning of World War I, when the warring nations were bogged down in a seemingly endless trench warfare, one of the German commanders decided to begin to utilize chemical warfare, poison gas chemicals, Germany being really in a dominant position to do that because of their very strong dye industry that had been developed over the years. They began to use and to experiment with different types of poison gases, beginning with chlorine gas, and they began to wield it in 1915, followed shortly thereafter by their adversaries. And so quickly, World War I battlefields became a scene of horrific chemical warfare. And as part of that chemical warfare, gas chambers were used both for research purposes in the laboratory to develop new kinds of poison gases and also in training to put all recruits who were about ready to go into the battlefield through a program of hands-on training that required them to be subjected to poison gases and to use defensive measures such as gas masks to attempt to ward them off. So gas chambers became much more numerous.
You know, after the First World War, the horrors of poison gas really kind of shook both the American public and the European publics. And it seems kind of paradoxical that although poison gas was seen as so horrific, that executing criminals in the gas chamber was seen as relatively humane. How did that change in perception happen?
Well, certainly there were some interests in society who had a vested interest in trying to indicate that poison gas deaths were quick and instantaneous and seemingly humane. On the one hand, gases were increasingly being used as anesthetics in medicine and in some cases for animal euthanasia. On the other hand, the chemical industry, which was facing possible civil damages as a result of accidental deaths from various chemicals, as well as the military, which was seeking to continue to promote chemical gases, chemical warfare to some extent, they wanted to try to demonstrate that these deaths from chemicals were actually much more humane than other kinds of deaths that might occur on the battlefield, such as shooting. And so there was a campaign that was waged, an advertising and public relations campaign, that various agencies of the government and private interests waged to try to promote the idea of gassing as a humane form of killing.
So the first execution took place in 1924 in the state of Nevada. Could you take us through that first execution? Did it actually draw public attention? Were people aware of it?
Well, it did. Beginning in 1921, the state of Utah, with encouragement from the Chemical Warfare Service and other agencies, began to advocate for a humane execution law in the state of Nevada, and indeed the first execution was carried out in February 1924, involving a Chinese-American inmate named Guy John, who had been convicted of murder. And at that time, his proposed execution in Nevada caught the attention of many people, particularly members of the anti-war movement and persons who were concerned about the continued use of chemical weapons in a future military conflict. They, among others, were particularly concerned about the use of chemical agents to carry out an execution, and there was some interest and some protest around the world for that reason. But the execution did proceed, and Guy John became the first person to be legally executed by lethal gas.
I thought an odd part of the story was the fact that one of the people there at the execution thought he could bring Guy back to life.
Well, actually, this had occurred with electrocution as well. Some of the scientists involved at that time being particularly concerned about the nature of death from either electricity or, in this case, lethal gas, were fascinated by how this occurred, and they wanted to learn more about it, and they thought, well, here we have a captive subject. Perhaps we could subject this person to a lethal dose and then somehow revive him or her, bring them back to life, and learn more about how this process of death was occurring before maybe we finish them off. This was one of the kinds of macabre notions that was attached to the first execution.
Now, the development of the American gas chamber took off from there. I got from the book that first execution actually took place in a converted barber shop. And I know that as time went on, certain developments had occurred in American industry to kind of refine the process. There was a company in Denver that really kind of became the go-to shop to get a gas chamber. Could you tell us a little bit about them?
The Eaton Metal Products Company, based in Denver and located throughout the western states, and which had been involved in building gas tanks and grain bins and other large steel receptacles with specially treated steel, often treated with cyanide, in fact, to help harden that steel, became involved, was appointed by the warden of the Colorado Penitentiary to build a specially constructed and designed gas chamber, not some sort of a makeshift shed that could be used to gas someone, but something that would be safe to the witnesses and the staff carrying it out, as well as very lethal to the person that, or persons who were being executed. The Eaton Company began to manufacture gas chambers, and indeed, during the 1930s, there was a wave of gas chamber construction throughout the United States. Eaton filed a patent, received a patent from the U.S. Patent Office, and built gas chambers in eight states. And so gassing became identified with the United States.
Eaton came to regret his involvement with it, though.
The designer of the gas chamber who held the patent many years later said that he did regret that he had constructed such a thing.
So early in this conversation, I talked about the twin images of American prisons and German concentration camps. But as one reads your book, it's kind of hard to get away from the fact that there seems to be a relationship between American chemical companies, German chemical companies, and the Hitler government in the 1930s. What was the nature of the relationship between American chemical concerns and the Hitler government?
Well, there was a very long-standing relationship between and competition between German and American and British, for that matter, companies in the chemical field. And the Germans had long dominated that particular industry. But beginning in the early 20th century, the Americans began to offer some competition, which increased over time. There was a cartel that was formed, an international cartel, involving German interests, represented by IG Farben, which was a conglomeration of German companies, and American companies, DuPont, American Cyanamid, a number of other chemical companies. And indeed, they worked to fix prices, they exchanged technical information and patents, they helped to develop and to manufacture certain kinds of deadly chemicals, such as Zyklon, which was ultimately used in the Nazi concentration camps. And they conspired together to develop more and more lethal poisons. This went on not only in the time leading up to World War II, but actually into World War II, and a number of American companies were indicted by the United States government in the 1930s and later in the 40s for their collusion with the Germans. And actually, during World War II, there continued to be secret channels of communication and certain kind of technical exchange between these companies, which was done in Basel, Switzerland. And so it continued even during the war. And then when the war was over, business as usual resumed.
Was there suppression of what was going on in Germany in the Allied media? I mean, did Western societies know the extent of German gassing, or were there efforts to try to clamp down on the information that was coming out of Germany?
Well, there was a great deal of information that was coming out about the gassings that were going on in Germany and later in Eastern Europe. This was being disseminated not only in Jewish publications, but it was also the subject of a lot of intelligence that was flowing through the American and British operations. One spy in particular got a lot of information that indicated that the Germans were developing poison gases, that IG Farben was doing this, and that they were intending to invade the Soviet Union, and so on. So there was a lot of information beforehand being passed on, even before the horrible gassing was being carried out. This continued during the war, but it wasn't until later in the war that the United States claimed to have the ability to strategically bomb or to interfere with these death camps manufacturing centers of the poison gases. So the gassing went on, and millions of people died in these horrible concentration camps. It was really mind-boggling to everyone involved that such a horrific genocidal crime could be going on. And while there was information coming out that this was going on, many people just simply didn't or couldn't believe it. And it wasn't until the camps were taken over by the American and Russian forces, and they saw the actual results, that people began to believe what had previously been the subject of intelligence reports and letters smuggled out of Europe.
You know, even after the horrors of the concentration camps were revealed, America still used the gas chamber to execute criminals. Really, up until, I think you said, the last execution by gas was 1999 in Arizona. So what were the forces that finally turned the U.S. public against using gas chambers?
Throughout the world, there was a tremendous revulsion as the crimes of the Nazis was brought forth in trials at Nuremberg and elsewhere. It took a while for this to really fully sink in. But during the 1950s and then into the 1960s, as it did sink in, many countries, and even in the United States, began to really shy away from the capital punishment generally, and the use of the gas chamber in particular. The United States remained the only country to be using lethal gas, but it really fell out of favor. It really was under a cloud because of the whole experience of the Holocaust. And it was only in a few states, California and Colorado and North Carolina, a few others, that continued to use it as their predominant method of execution. Ultimately, it became even more and more unpopular. There was a moratorium on capital punishment that existed in the United States from the late 1960s into the mid-70s. It's hard to imagine today because we have a very different public mood, but at that time, the majority of Americans opposed capital punishment. But as a result of agitation by conservatives, capital punishment was brought back. And at that time, one of the ways that they managed to bring it back was to substitute lethal injection for lethal gas. And so it was only through a few final executions that gassings took place. It was largely replaced by lethal injection. And in 1994, in federal court in San Francisco, a federal judge, upon examining voluminous evidence that had been presented, concluded that execution by lethal gas violated the Constitution. It was cruel and unusual punishment. It presented a substantial risk of suffering, extensive pain for several minutes, and therefore it couldn't be used in the state of California. So it was discontinued in California, and through a quirk, the final execution in Arizona involving a volunteer, someone who personally chose to be executed by gas, and ironically at that a German national, was executed, ending the 75-year reign of the gas chamber that actually began in the United States.
Scott Christensen, the author of The Last Gasp, The Rise and Fall of the American Gas Chamber, thanks so much for being on the University of California Press podcast today.
Thank you very much, Chris.
For information about this book and our other titles, please visit our website at www.ucpress.edu. You can also become a fan of the UC Press on Facebook, or you can follow us on Twitter, where we are at UC Press. Thanks for listening to this episode of the University of California Press podcast. Copyright 2010, the University of California Press. All rights reserved.